Bible to 1 Samuel chapter 16. 1 Samuel chapter 16. Hope you've had a productive day and been beneficial. You've heard me say many times, if I get a nap, it's a good afternoon. And I've got a nap, and so we're good to go. I think the story of David and Goliath may be one of the greatest Old Testament stories. It seems to be children's favorite. I can remember as a little boy it being one of my favorite. What I want to do today is go over the details of that story, but have you look at it, some of the surrounding things that maybe as a child you didn't learn that might be of benefit to you. Beginning in chapter 16, I want you to look with me for a moment. The Lord had already told Samuel to tell King Saul two times, two separate times, your kingdom is gone, your kingdom is over. Samuel knew that Saul had a fierce temper, and he was scared of him. So in chapter 16 and verse 1, the Lord said to Samuel, how long will you grieve over Saul? He wasn't doing the things the Lord wanted him to do, much like when Elijah was in the cave for 30 days and God gave him 30 days to weep and mourn over the fact that Jezebel was trying to kill him. But he said to him, I have rejected him from being king over Israel. Fill your horn with oil. That might be our way of saying, pick it up and let's go. We've got other things to do. So he says, you need to get your horn ready that he used for anointing the first king because you're about to anoint the second king. Fill your horn with oil and go, and I will send you to Jesse the Bethlehemite, for I have selected a king for myself amongst his sons. I want you to look back with me in chapter 13 and verse 13. In 13 and 13, this is the time, you remember, that King Saul was supposed to wait for Samuel to come and make an offering before fighting the Philistines, and he got tired of waiting, so he decided he was going to do it on his own. This was the first major blunder that he made. And in chapter 13 and verse 13, Samuel said to Saul, you have acted foolishly. You have not kept the commands of the Lord your God, which he had commanded you, for now the Lord will have established your kingdom forever. That was God's plan initially. In verse 14, but now your kingdom will not endure. The Lord has sought for himself a man after his own heart, and the Lord has appointed him as ruler over his people because you have not kept what the Lord had commanded. So I want you to understand that from the first mistake that Saul made, God had already determined he wasn't the man. In fact, let me just say, God had determined that a long time before. The people wanted a warrior. They wanted a mighty man. They were tired in the time of the judges of waiting and hoping that God would bring somebody. Please bring somebody. Make something happen to save us. And they all got tired of it. They wanted a mighty warrior. And so the Lord knew exactly what they were looking for. So he picked a man, the son of a man named Kish. Kish was a massive warrior, huge man. He picked his son. And because he said, this is exactly what you wanted, and I'm going to make certain you don't come back to me and say, oh, if you had just given us what we wanted. No, God said, I'm giving you exactly what you wanted. What you're going to see the second time is God said, the second time I'm picking what I want. In the 15th chapter, you see again in verse 23. Chapter 15 and verse 23, the second time Samuel says to Saul, your kingdom is over. It wasn't going to stop immediately, but it would very shortly. So in chapter 15 and verse 23, the latter part of that verse, because you have rejected the word of the Lord, he has rejected you from being king. Now let's go back now to chapter 16 and verse 2 and look at this for just a moment. So Samuel had already told Saul two different times, a good amount of maybe a number of years apart, your kingdom is not going to be handed down to your son, Jonathan. In fact, it's going to be ripped away from you because you're not the kind of man that God is looking for. What's interesting is in chapter 16 and verse 2, this is what Samuel, what was in his mind. Samuel said, how can I? When Saul hears it, he will kill me. He's scared to death of Saul. He realizes, you're going to see in time, that every time Saul gets angry, he loses control of his emotions and he just blows up in a rage and starts throwing spears at people and doing all kinds of things in his life. And Samuel was afraid of him. prophet of God somehow felt like, I don't think this is going to work, God. Maybe we just need to do something else. So he says in verse 3, and the Lord said in verse 2, you take a heifer and say, I have come to sacrifice to the Lord, and you go to Jesse's house. It's interesting that if you study Judges chapter 6, when God comes to Gideon, you remember, and Gideon is hiding out in a cave trying to press some grain to feed his family. And the angel comes to Gideon and he says to him, oh, mighty man of valor. And Gideon says, who are you talking to? Me? You're talking to me? I'm hiding here from the Midianite people trying to feed my family. And he began talking about all the bad things that had happened. How, if God is with us, how can this happen and this happen and this happen? And the angel of the Lord didn't spend 1 second of time answering his issue. He just said, go. I've given you something to do, now go do it. Isn't it amazing that this great man of God, Samuel, when God says, get your horn ready, we're going to anoint the next king, the first thing that he offers to God is, but I'm afraid of Saul. What's he going to do to me? Look into verse 6 and 7. I want you to look at this for just a moment. He tells Saul something, Samuel rather, something that's very important. When you're going to the house of Jesse, you're not going to look at people like human beings look at people. I want to teach you, Samuel, how to look at people like God looks at people. Now, it was because of how people looked at King Saul when they saw him after they grabbed him from the baggage and they brought him up and they said, he's the one. He's the one we're looking for. He's the kind of guy we're looking for, because they were making a judgment based on how people look. How many times today do you think you look at someone, especially younger people, you look at someone and you decide they're going to be my friend. They're going to be somebody I want to be close to. They're going to be somebody I want to date or marry, when you don't have a clue about what's on the inside of them. I hope as we get older as Christians, you realize that how a person looks on the outside is completely irrelevant. But look at what happens in chapter 16 and verse 6. Chapter 16 and verse 6. It came about when they entered and looked at Eliab and thought, surely the Lord's anointed is before him. He saw the oldest boy. He was a grown man. He looked handsome. He's going to be a pretty good warrior. This must be the guy. In verse 7, the Lord said to Samuel, do not look at his appearance or at his height or his stature, because I have rejected him. I rejected somebody just like Eliab already, because he looked like a king, but he wasn't my kind of man on the inside. For God sees not as man sees. For man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. That ought to be a lesson that every single human being understands and grabs. As you become a Christian and grow in your life, you understand you cannot look at the fruit from the outside and tell anything about a person's heart. In many cases, it is a matter of, has somebody been battle tested? And you're going to learn that David was that kind of young man. He calls in verse 8. He brings in boys. Bring all your boys in here, Jesse. So he starts with the oldest and he goes down and down, and he knows what he's looking for. And he gets through them and he says to Jesse, are these all of your boys? He said, yes, I've got one little kid out here tending sheep, but surely you don't want him. And Samuel said, bring him in to me. Bring him to me. When he brought David in, instantly when he saw David, somehow the Lord had allowed him to know this is the one. Now, the older brothers were livid. The father thought he was crazy. But God was looking at the inside of this man's heart. Look in verse 10. Jesse had made 7 of his sons pass before Samuel, but Samuel said to Jesse, the Lord has not chosen these. I would have known if he had. In verse 11, Samuel said to Jesse, are these all the children? And he said, there remains yet one, the youngest, and he's tending sheep. And Samuel said to Jesse, send and bring him, for we will not sit down until he comes, because my job's not finished yet. I came here with oil to anoint a king, and I haven't seen the king yet. In verse 12, when he sent and brought him, now he was ruddy with beautiful eyes and a handsome appearance. And the Lord said, arise and anoint him, for this is the one. I'm going to tell you that David could not have been any more than a teenager when this happened. He's not going to be the king for a number of years, but God had already picked him. He'd already put him into service, and you're going to see that. There are some amazing things that happened before the story of David and Goliath that I want you to understand. Saul has been told twice, your kingdom will not endure. Your son will not be the next king. You will not fill out your term because of things that you've done wrong. God has already told Samuel to tell Saul, God has picked somebody like him. But Saul, who has this tremendous temper, has no clue who that person is. Now let me tell you what's going to be amazing. You're going to see in just a little bit. Saul, through a very interesting way, takes the next king and he brings him right in and puts him in Saul's house. Now you want to talk about rubbing it in somebody's face. David has a talent. The talent is playing a harp. The people around Saul figure out that when Saul hears the playing of a harp, his temper calms down. Now God is picking a way of taking the next king and bringing him right in and putting him in the palace in the house of Saul. I want to show you how that works out in just a moment. In verse 13, Samuel took the horn of oil and anointed him in the midst of his brothers, and the Spirit of the Lord came mightily upon David from that day forward. That's language you see throughout all of the Judges. You see it back in the time of Joshua. God gives people miraculous power, tremendous power. In verse 14, the Spirit of the Lord had departed from Saul, and an evil spirit from the Lord terrorized him. You're going to see how that evil spirit terrorizes him in a time. In verse 16 and 17, they determined that if they could find a skillful player of the harp, it would be something that would calm Saul down. And they try it, and in fact, it happens. In verse 17, Saul sent his servant, provide for me now a man who can play well and bring him to me. Then one of the young men answered and said, behold, I have seen a son of Jesse, the Bethlehemite, who is a skilled musician, a mighty man of valor, a warrior, a prudent in speech, and a handsome man, and the Lord is with him. But they didn't have any clue that young man that they just described had already been anointed by Samuel to be the next king. They wouldn't know that for quite a long time, but it had already happened. If you look a little bit further now, verse 19, you can see David was with the flock and they got him and they brought him in. In verse 21, David came to Saul and attended him, and Saul loved him greatly. And he became an armor bearer. And Saul said to Jesse, saying, let David now stand before me, for he has found favor in my sight. But this is something I want you to think about when we finish the story of David and Goliath. Saul is watching this battle. He's watching this young man come down the valley, down the hills to the valley. He's not very far away from this giant. The giant is always had been used to people standing toe to toe, nose to nose, eyeball to eyeball. And that's how he had fought all his life. He was not used to someone being like a jackrabbit and running here and there and coming up on him quickly. So not only was the Lord with him, but what I would tell you that's amazing is when Saul looks at that, Saul says, who is that young man? Who is that young man that just killed the giant? Not realizing it was David, the little boy that played at the harp in his house and had become his armor bearer all this time. He had no clue, looking at a distance, knowing who this young person was. We'll come back to that in a moment. In verse 23, it came about when an evil spirit from God came to Saul, David would take the harp and play it with his hand, and Saul would be refreshed and be well, and an evil spirit would depart from him. I don't know if he just had a vicious and vile temper, or if God actually plagued him with some type of evil spirit. I don't really know which one it is. I will tell you that multiple times, after the event where David killed Goliath, as they're marching into town after this great battle of the Philistines, and the women alongside here are singing a song. And Saul is saying, what are they saying? What are they saying? And he begins hearing. And what they were saying was, Saul has killed his thousands, but David has killed his 10,000s. And now he starts looking with suspicion at this young man. On several occasions, he will try to kill David going forward. But what I would tell you is, what more classic way could God torment someone with an evil spirit than put the person that they will come to despise right in his house, living with him and seeing him every day? And it was this young man who was about the only thing that could calm Saul down when his temper got the best of him. So he's going to search the world over trying to find the next king and not realize that God had put him right in his house where he was looking at him every day. In chapter 17, we have the great story here. You can see in verses 3, 4, 5, and 6, this man Goliath, he's not called by name until verse 23. He's just called the great champion. And look at a description, if you will, please. In verse 3, the Philistines stood on the mountain on one side, while Israel stood on the mountain on the other side with the valley between them. This was pretty common for battle in this day and time. Then a champion came from the armies of the Philistines named Goliath from Gath, whose height was 6 cubits and a span. If you want to do some study one of these days, there was a group of people called the Nephilim who were giant people. You can see it all the way back to Genesis chapter 6. They were oftentimes called the sons of Anak. They were people that lived amongst the Philistines, but they were giant people. Now, when you start reading about this man Goliath, he was bigger than most of them, but they were a mighty people that were talked about throughout all the Old Testament. You want to go back to why it was in Joshua's day where they had driven out about 90% of all the people they were supposed to drive out from the land of Canaan, but they left the Philistines right amongst them. And the reason was they were scared to death of the Philistines because Goliath was not the only great warrior that they had. They had many more. But look at this in verse 4. His height was 6 cubits and a span. Back in the day, a cubit was here. Something around 18 inches. My math says that he was between 9.5 and 10.25 feet tall. So something around a 10-foot tall man. And he had a bronze helmet on his head, which he clothed with a scale armor, which weighed about 5,000 shekels of bronze. His breastplate weighed about 150 pounds. Verse 6, he had a bronze greaves on his leg and bronze javelin slung between his shoulder, and the shaft of his spear was like a weaver's beam. We might call it a fence post. And the head of the spear weighed 600 shekels of iron. The head of his spear was around 18 to 20 pounds. Now, pretty amazing. In verse 8, he stood and shouted to the ranks of Israel and said to them, "Why do you not come out and draw up in battle array? Am I not a Philistine, and you servants of Saul? Choose the man for yourself and let him come down to me." Now the Philistines had learned a trick, and that is, let's not have a whole bunch of people get killed. There's no reason for thousands of people to get killed. We'll just send our warrior and you send your warrior down, and whoever wins that fight, it's over with. Well, that had served them very well for a period of time. The problem is, the armies of Israel were scared to death of this man. That's why, you're going to see in a minute, he comes out bellowing morning and evening for 40 straight days by the time that David hears him. So you can see in verse 10, the Philistine said, "I defy the ranks of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together." When Saul and all Israel heard this words of the Philistines, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. I'm going to ask you a question when we finish this. It seems to me that Goliath was bigger than God to them. They were more afraid of Goliath than they were of God. I go back and think about how many stories in the Bible, as an example, in the time when the midwives in Exodus chapter 1, the midwives would deliver babies. And the king said to them, "You need to kill every boy baby." And they wouldn't do it. They would not do it. And the reason they said so was because we're a whole lot more afraid of God than we are of the king. And because of that, God in time gave them great families and blessed them greatly, the two midwives that you see in Exodus 1. I'm going to tell you, you see the opposite here. You see people who are far more afraid of Goliath than they are of God. Do you know that most Christians, I believe, most human beings have something in their life that's bigger than God? You know it because you can see how they act. It may be their job. It may be their parents. It may be a husband or wife. It may be children. It may be what people think about them. Who knows what it may be, but you can tell by the way they act. As much as they say they love God, there's something bigger that scares them more than God does. And what I will tell you in this story, what Goliath really represents is somebody that was bigger than God to this whole army of people. But look in verse 13. So David comes in verse 12. He has eight brothers. Three of them, you can see in verse 3, three of them are in the army with Saul. So he comes up and you can see the three that are there. Eliab, Abinadab, and Shammah. David was the youngest. In verse 16, the Philistine came forward in morning and evening for 40 days and took his stand. Now you can see in verse 22 and 23, David comes up. And he is bringing provisions for his three brothers and perhaps other people. And he's just talking with them about how's the war going? How are things going? And all of a sudden he hears something he'd never heard before. He had not been there apparently in the 40 days that Goliath had been doing this. So he hears this bellowing sound out, basically cursing the people of God. So in verse 23, he was talking with them, and behold, the champion, the Philistine from Gath named Goliath, was coming up with the armies of the Philistines, and he spoke these same words, and David heard them for the first time, I would guess. When all the men of Israel saw this man, they fled from him and were greatly afraid. In verse 26, verse 25, David asked a question. It's a pretty interesting question. He's just asking a question. Have they offered any kind of reward for the person that tried to kill this? Well, his older brother heard that and he was incensed. What are you talking about? What are you doing? And so he says to him, "What? I'm just asking a question." Look at the question just for a moment in verse 28. Eliab, the older brother, when he spoke to him, saying, Eliab's anger burned against David when he, as he said, "Why have you come down? And with whom have you left a few sheep in the wilderness? I know your insolence and your wickedness of heart, for you have come down in order to see the battle." But David said, "What have I done? Was it not just a question?" That's a pretty good indication that these guys are a little sensitive, aren't they? Every time Goliath bellows, they're hiding like scared dogs. But they don't like the fact that their little brother is seeing this and asking questions. In verse 31, when the words of David were heard, they were told to Saul, and he sent for him. And David said to Saul, "Let no man's heart fail on the account of him. Your servant will go and fight this Philistine." And Saul said to David, "You're not able to go against the Philistines to fight him. You are but a youth, and you have been a warrior he has been a warrior from his youth." And David said to Saul, "Your servant was tending his father's sheep when a lion and a bear came and took the lamb and the flock. And when I went after him and attacked him and rescued it from his mouth, and when he rose up against me, I seized him by the beard and struck him and killed him. Your servant has killed both a lion and a bear, and this uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them, since he taunted the armies of the living God." And David said, "The Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion and the paw of the bear, he will deliver me from the hand of the Philistine." And Saul said to David, "Go, and may the Lord be with you." What happened in this little episode was Saul realized this was not some goofy little kid's fantasy. David had already fought a lion and a bear. And he was confident that God had helped him do this. Now, David may have just been the toughest guy in the world and God had nothing to do with it, but don't believe that. So Saul realized this is not just some kind of kid fantasy that this little fella wants to go fight Goliath. He's got something going on here. I don't know what it is, but he's got something. So he begins to say to him, let's get ready. Get my armor. Well, you know the story how the armor was way too large. David was used to fighting a certain type of warfare. I can remember a good many years ago, I was doing a lesson, a Sunday morning lesson on the story of David and Goliath. And I was watching a movie called The Patriot, starring Mel Gibson. Some of you may have seen that movie. It's a great movie and one of my favorites. But they made a point in that movie, and that was, so the British people always fought the same way. How did they fight? They had red, white, and blue uniforms. They all stood in a line, and they all stood up together, and they walked up together like this. They stood and fired. Do you know where the revolutionaries fought? Behind rocks and up in trees and down in valleys. And they basically slaughtered one of the greatest armies in the world. Here was a case where warfare had been fought a particular way. And that is, you stand up eyeball to eyeball and you just club each other to death. And that's pretty much how it went. Some years ago, Linda and I were up in the Boston area, Cambridge and Lexington, right across the river from actually where MIT and Harvard are. And that was the latter battles of the Revolutionary War. Some of you, I know, have been there. Now, what's amazing is this. You're walking along there, and here is a stake, and it says, this is where the British Army was camped the night before the last war. And you're walking over here, about 200 feet away, and here is a sign that says, this is where the American Army was. And it's like two backyards away from one another. In those days, they didn't have warfare where you could shoot from 500 miles away and hit somebody. They were literally eyeball to eyeball. Most of the muskets back in those days would not fire over 50 feet. Do you remember an old saying? Some of you do. Back in the revolutionary days, don't fire until you see the whites in their eyes. You know why? Because they couldn't hit anything further than 50, 60, 70 feet away. What you see with David is he was not used to putting on battle armor and standing eyeball to eyeball. He didn't do that with the bear, and he didn't do that with the lion. And he, although he was a warrior, that's not what he was used to doing. But look in verse 44. The Philistine came to David, come to me, and I will give your flesh to the birds of the sky and the beasts of the field. This is what we would call trash talking. Then David said to the Philistines, you come to me with a sword and a spear and a javelin, verse 45, but I come to you in the name of the Lord God of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have taunted. This day, he says, the Lord will deliver you from his hand, and I will strike you down and remove your head from you, and I will give the dead body of the army of the Philistines this day to the birds of the sky and the wild beasts of the earth, that the earth may know that there is a God in Israel. And the assemblies may know that the Lord does not deliver by sword or by spear, but the battle of the Lord, and he is the Lord, and he will give you into our hands. Then it happened that when the Philistine rose and came and drew near to meet David, that David ran quickly toward the battle line to meet the Philistine. This Philistine, I want you to imagine, this massive lumbering man. Think about there being two mountains here and a flat spot down here. So you have the army of Israel here and the army of the Philistines here. Both of these men are making their way down to here where they're going to fight. Goliath, a big, massive man who is carrying hundreds of pounds of armor, and he has a massive spear and a massive shield that we didn't even talk about, and he is slowly lumbering down here trying to get to the bottom where he's going to fight. David, a young man who had probably nothing but sandals and a loincloth and a slingshot and a little sack, and he's running wide open to get down here to fight this man. Goliath had never seen anything like that. He'd never fought that kind of battle before. Now take a look a little bit further. Verse 48 again, it happened when the Philistines rose and came near to meet David, that David ran quickly toward the battle line to meet the Philistine. And David put his hand in the bag and took from it a stone and slung it and struck the Philistine in the forehead. I left one part of this out. Somebody tell me, how many stones did he gather altogether? Isn't that interesting? When I read that story as a little kid, I thought, did he think he was going to miss three or four times? Did he think it was going to take five to bring him down? Or maybe he was just planning. It just took one. Just took one. That's all he needed. And so in verse 49, David put his hand in the bag and took the stone and slung it and slung the Philistine in the forehead. And the stone sank into his forehead so that he fell on his face to the ground. If you ever do a little bit, if you wanted to, would like to Google, I did this some a few years ago. If you were to look at Philistine armor, you're going to see this massive helmet that basically comes down here and comes to about here. And do you know what part of the entire body, from his feet all the way right up through all of the scaled armor that he had, do you know where the only place that was exposed on his whole body was? Right here. A little spot that was about 1 inch by 3 inches. Where did the stone hit? It sunk right in the middle of this guy's of Goliath's forehead. When I think back some of the stories we've studied, like the way we're going to defeat back in the time of the judges, we're going to defeat this massive army, Gideon. You don't need 30,000 men. You don't need 10,000 men. 300. Well, what's going to be what kind of armament are we going to have? You're going to have a trumpet, and you're going to have a big pipe, a vessel, and you're going to have a torch that you light. And the people are going to be scared to death and kill each other. Oh, that sounds like a great battle plan. Man, why didn't our warriors, people in West Point and other places think about a battle plan like that? Or march around the city 7 times on the 7th day. When we blow the horn, all of you shout, and all of the stones are going to fall to the ground. Now, they ought to be teaching that right now in West Point and in Annapolis, right? It's pretty clear that these men from the army, the Israelite army, had seen the power of God over and over and over. They had not internalized it. They did not believe that he was going to help them, even though there are stories that they had read about for 1,000 years. But Goliath was bigger than God to them. In verse 50... David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling and a stone, and he struck the Philistine and killed him, but there was no sword in David's hand. Well, why did that matter? Because he had told Goliath, I'm cutting your head off and taking it home with me today. But he didn't have a sword. In verse 51, David ran and stood over the Philistine and took his sword and drew it out of his sheath and killed him and cut off his head with it. When the Philistines saw that their champion was dead, they fled. You got any idea how big the head of a 10-foot tall man is? That had to be a massive head. But here's what's going to be interesting. David's going to take that head back to his tent. When he is called to come meet with King Saul some days later, what do you think he has in his hand? Goliath's head. He took it as a trophy. In verse 52, the men of Israel and Judah arose and shouted and pursued the Philistine as far as the entrance of the valley and the gates of Ekron, and the slain Philistines laid along the way to Sherem and even to Gath and Ekron. And the sons of Israel returned from chasing the Philistines and plundered their camp. Here's what's amazing about this story to me. They weren't afraid of the Philistine soldiers. They were afraid of Goliath. Once Goliath was dead, they came after them like there was nothing left. They were chasing them like rabbits. The only thing that they were afraid of was this massive man that was bigger than what they had ever seen, and it literally scared them to death. Every time he yelled out, they were petrified. In verse 54, David took the Philistine's head and brought it to Jerusalem, but he put his weapon in his tent. Now when Saul saw David going out against the Philistines, he said to Abner, the commander of the army, Abner, whose son is this young man? And Abner said, "By your life, O king, I do not know." Go back to chapter 16 again. This is one of those interesting things. Chapter 16, which happened obviously before the battle, we see this. Verse 21, chapter 16 and verse 21. David came to Saul and attended him, and Saul loved him greatly. Isn't that interesting? And he became his armor bearer. And Saul sent to Jesse, saying, "Let David now stand before me, for he has found favor in my sight." And it would come about when an evil spirit from God came to Saul, David would take the harp and play it with his hand, and Saul would be refreshed as well, and the evil spirit would depart from him. Why is it that when he sees this young man out here in the battlefield, he doesn't have a clue who he is? And Abner, who's the head of his military, didn't know who he was either. Oh, he's going to find out who David is. Very quickly, he's going to know David better than he would like to. Verse 55, when Saul saw David going out against the Philistine, he asked, "Whose son is this young man?" In verse 56, and the king said, you inquire whose son the youth is. When David returned from killing the Philistine, Abner took him and brought him before Saul, and the Philistine's head in his hand. He carried it back to Jerusalem, and now he's brought it right in for Saul to see. And Saul said to him, "Who are you, young man?" And David said, "I am the son of your servant Jesse, the Bethlehemite." Why did he not know him before? I get the impression that Saul was a very arrogant man. He also was a very suspicious man. He'd already been told twice that his throne was going to be taken away from him, and he probably never even saw David. He loved the music, he loved what he provided, but he probably had 1,000 or 5,000 other servants. And so this little servant didn't make any difference to him. But when he's watching from the top of this mountain and he sees this young fellow jumping like a rabbit and running down probably no more than 30 or 40 or 50 feet from this giant and slings this slingshot, and he sees this massive man fall flat on his face. I've studied a little bit about this, and this kind of comes back maybe a little bit to football days. When somebody's standing up and you shoot them or you hit them, normally they fall backwards. The impact of the bullet, the impact of what hit them, causes them to fall backwards. Goliath fell flat on his face. So I have no doubt that when David got there, he was laying face down in the dirt. What you're going to see in our next story, look at verse 7, 18 and 7. It happened as they were coming that David returned from killing the Philistines, that the women came out of the city singing and dancing to meet King Saul with tambourines and joy and musical instruments. And the women sang as they played, "Saul has slain his 1,000 and David his 10,000. And Saul became very angry. In verse 8, he makes a statement. He's so angry. He says in chapter 8 and verse 8, "What, David kills his 10,000 and they ascribe to me thousands?" And he says in verse 8, "Now what more can he have but the kingdom?" Isn't that interesting? What's he going to have in a few years? The kingdom. In verse 9, "And Saul looked at David with suspicion from that day forward." In verse 12, "Saul was afraid of David, for the Lord was with him and had departed Saul." He began figuring out, the person who is my enemy, God has placed him right in my household. That becomes quite an epic battle going forward. The question I'd ask you as we close up is this: what's the closest thing to Goliath in your life? What is it? Is there anything that is bigger to you than God? Is there anything that you're more afraid of than God? That's what this story is all about, isn't it? I mean, it's the major part of the story. And the story is not, this great young man and he's becoming king. All of that's a wonderful story. But what was amazing was the entire army of the people of God, who for 1,000 years had seen God perform miracle after miracle after miracle, were completely stymied and they were like dogs. They were scared to death of this one man. It is amazing how many times you think about Matthew chapter 6, where he talks about you cannot love God and mammon. But you don't really know, none of us do, exactly where you fit in that program. Do I love God or do I love things of this earth until they come in direct contradiction to one another? And that's when you get a chance to stare eyeball to eyeball and see, is mammon bigger or is God bigger? I'm going to tell you, the entire Israelite army was more afraid of mammon than they were of God. And mammon was personified in the form of Goliath. That's what they were afraid of. When he died, they didn't have any problem fighting the Philistines. They had done it several times before, and they did it again. But they were scared to death of this one man. And they cowered like little animals. Thank you for listening to me. We have a song that we're going to sing tonight that Brother Charles is going to lead us in. I think about every aspect of life as I've tried to preach over the years. You get to thinking about, how can we do this? How can we afford to do this? How can we make this happen? How can we do this and that? And every single one of us have a tendency of going right to the human aspect. What can we afford to do? What can we accomplish? And when a few times, in fact, I would say in the building of this building, we had some conversations about this. If all of this is just about math, let's just get the smartest mathematician to tell us if we can afford to build this building. If, however, you believe what you're doing is God's will, He's going to bless it, and you're going to be successful. And you don't need a mathematician, and you don't need an engineer. What you need is faith. Now, how many times have we failed to talk to people, failed to get involved in something, failed to agree to make a little talk, or to teach a class, or to do 100 different things because I'm afraid, I'm afraid, I'm afraid? How many times in our life has the devil whipped us because between our ears we're more afraid of failure or being embarrassed than we are being the one talent man? We need faith. We don't need math. Just faith. If anyone needs to respond in any way, let it be known as we stand together and sing.